coffee, and I would take the left-wing newspaper, the right-wing newspaper, and the middle-of-the-road newspaper, and I wouldn't even turn on my communications until I had read through those, because I needed to know, in whatever microcosm was, what was going on. So I think that, you know, it's again, is the characteristics of an agency officer or an intel officer is more of a jack of all trades than an expert. You know, I think that our analysts, for example, are the most incredible. I mean, I love our analysts. We couldn't do our work without them. They have the luxury of coming in and picking a topic, and they can carry that topic for their whole career. And I know a guy, we EOD together, enter duty together, and he literally went from GS 10 or 11 to an SISer doing the same kind of work, just more and more sophisticated and more knowledgeable, where we have to go to different countries, learn different languages, learn different customs. For me, the transition of terrorism was heaven sent, because I still like that part of it. I mean, I've done the other. I've done some great recruitments of diplomatic circuit individuals, and I do own a tuxedo to this day, so I clean up well. But deep in my heart, I like getting my hands dirty, and I like meeting folks. And that period in Latin America, where I was literally, I literally recruited a terrorist through coercion, but nonetheless, it was something that it was easy in my character to say, hey, this is justifiable, and of course, we had the permissions to do so. It was an easier transition than somebody that was used to, you know, Paris or something like that, and all of a sudden now they're being sent to a place where it is a third world, and people are trying to kill you.
Another thing that I find quite interesting is, it seems to me from the book that you, a lot of your work is South or Central America, and then in East Asia, Korea, also North Africa, sorry. So there's quite a lot of ground that you cover. I guess the question is, for many people, like, you find your niche, you stick to the niche because it reaffirms your sense of self-worth, because you're the person that knows about that niche. So that seems to be the more typical thing, not just for people in intelligence, but just in life. But for someone like you to go from PJ to paramilitary to case officer, from Latin America to Korea to Shangri-La, there's a lot of lateral moves. There's a lot of adaptations and chameleon-like behavior, and I mean that in the best possible way. For people that are listening, like, how does one go about doing that? Because typically you just find the thing that you are comfortable with, you stick to that because it makes you feel secure, and then you don't move.
Perhaps I just have a short attention span and have to all of a sudden find, you know, I've conquered this, I got to go do something else. You know, our officers seldom do more than 3 years in country, because of exposure and just wear and tear. So you are going to be moving from different accounts and different cultures to a certain degree. For me, it came easy just because I wanted to go where the average person wasn't going. That was always my niche. Shangri-La was a perfect example. I was 4 years into my SIS rank when COFR said, hey, you know, I need you to get me somebody to go to Shangri-La and help us, you know, with the station that was just reopening. The embassy had been closed for a couple of years, I believe. And I couldn't find anybody. I made a bunch of phone calls to all the personnel officers, and they all said, no, we don't have anybody that's interested. And for several reasons. One was my wife did have a medical scare there when we were in Korea. And also because our kids were now of school age. They were in high school, different grades in high school. We decided we were not going to take any further overseas tours, that I would, you know, continue to do my work, but do it more from headquarters and TDYs. And so when I went to my wife with the fact that I said, look, I want to do this, it's going to be probably 6 to 8 months. She's a trooper. I mean, I couldn't have done anything that I did in my career without her. And you read that in the book, she even participated in some pretty cool adventures. But, it was that that change came natural, just chasing what was the highlight topic. And there's also, I think I included in the book, is that I didn't do any career planning. I never sat there and said, you know, I need to get this job in order to get my GS 13, 14, 15, or SIS. I always followed I hate to use the word the action, but where the importance of the pointy end of the spear needed to be. And there's two or three incidents in the book where those changes came to me. I wasn't looking for them. I was chief of the Koreas, and that's how I made senior grade. And I was the rep to the NSC for the agency on that hard targets board. And it was a great conventional job. I loved it. Again, fighting communism. Very sophisticated. I got involved in operations because I like to lead from the front. And that's in the book. At least one of them was what they allowed me to talk about. But, you know, I had Hank Crumpton, who to this day is a dear friend of mine. He called me up, and I had never met the man. I had heard of him. And he says, I want to talk to you. And he's the one that I went over, so we chatted over coffee, and he said, look, you know, I want you to be my replacement in a year. And I wasn't thinking of going back to the center at the time. So all of a sudden, I find myself back at the center as the chief of international terrorism, which was everything except Bin Laden. And then from there, moving to going to Shangri-La and coming back as the chief of ops. And then being the chief of ops when 9/11 actually happened. It's very similar to what happened to me in going to Costa Rica and going to Korea. It was the chief of station that had asked for me. In both those incidents, for different reasons, they had asked for me to be pitched to do that. And they were both surprising changes because in both cases, I was supposed to already assigned to another country. And at the last minute, you get this phone call that says, come here, the chief wants to talk to you. And I end up in these other two assignments, which were absolutely wonderful, but they weren't of my picking. Yeah, it was my, my mentors or leaders saying, that's a good fit for him.
That certainly comes across in the book. Like it wasn't a chess match of trying to get as far up the hierarchy as you could get. It was more, where is the action on the chessboard? That's where I want to be.
Yeah. I think that the greater majority of the agency folks, and you know, you got to understand, and you know this, the agency is not just operators. The guys who are ops officers, case officers, is a finite number. We cannot do anything without the support of everybody else, from logistics to security, for our analysts. It is a team sport. And each one of those individuals goes in that career track, logistics, security, whatever it is, but you do it through the agency because you believe in it. You believe that you're trying to make a bigger difference. So whether a DO officer or a DI officer or a DA officer, I found that the majority of the people that I worked with were mission-oriented. Whatever their mission was, mission-oriented. They were proud and they were very focused on making sure that they kept their end of whatever needed to be in operation. That said, like in any culture, I mean, in the military, you have guys who go in and, you know, the Billy Wahs of the world that go into harm's way for four tours in a row and have 8 Purple Hearts. And then you have the other ones that, you know, gravitate towards the circuit and become military attachés, and they all end up at the same place, but by different means. I was blessed with opportunities that allowed me to polish myself and to grow. And each one of these tours, because they were so different, when you come out of there, you have a different level of confidence because now you've conquered yet another culture or another challenging things or working at a different kind of a target.
Let's go forward to September the 10th, 2001. I think that's quite interesting because you're there at the counterterrorism center. News has came through about Ahmed Shah Massoud, who's been assassinated by Al-Qaeda operatives. In the book, you outline how you're thinking to yourself, this is pretty sophisticated, the way that they've done this. It seems like something else is happening. Take us back to that day, September the 10th. Help us understand what it was like to be Rick Prado on September the 10th, 2001.
You know, to paint you a better picture, I will start with again, one of these jobs that I was asked to take that I didn't even know existed, which was, I'm a plank owner of the Bin Laden Task Force. Mike Scheuer, a brilliant analyst, was the chief of the station, and I was the deputy chief of station. That was my first exposure to what became Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and everything else. So I had that knowledge behind me of their modus operandi. And the one thing that I learned really early on in counterterrorism, especially when it comes to the Al-Qaeda type of terrorism, is the guys who pulled off 9/11 had enough education to fly a 747 into a building. Killing Massoud was one of the most clinical operations anybody could tell. They went in there into the hornet's nest in that kind of dedication. So you cannot underestimate your enemy if you want to win your fights. So 9/11, I was like every single one of us, we know exactly where we were standing and what we were doing. And I knew there was something bigger. As soon as that second plane hit, my first comments to the chief of staff was, I need you to send out a cable to every station telling them, number one, watch your six. This is not a singleton act. And number two, turn up every rock, because we need to know who these guys are and where their softer belly buttons are at. That was my very first action. As you probably know, the agency was forced to evacuate because there was other planes, and they felt that the agency was a viable target. I mean, I would have hit it first, knowing what I know, but I guess they went for the political part of it, or the economic and impact. But CTC stayed open. The counterterrorist center stayed open. Kofor Black, who to this day is one of my dearest friends and mentor, he said, I'm not going anywhere. You're all free to go. And especially if you have kids that came out of school and all that other, you're free to go. But the counterterrorist center stayed open. I slept in my office for 3 nights without going home, literally taking showers in the gym. And one of my favorite stories of that period, and I use it to show the contrast from what the media portrays our people like to the reality of the courage and conviction that my colleagues display every single day. It was around 8 o'clock at night on 9/11. And I was making the rounds because, you know, CTC was a huge open area with gazillion cubicles. And I walk up to the area where Hezbollah branch was, because my office was on the other side. And there was this young lady that was sitting at the desk. She was the deputy of the Hezbollah branch. She was 8 months pregnant. And I walked up to her and I said, what are you doing here? And she says, well, I'm not convinced that this was Bin Laden. I want to make sure that it wasn't Hezbollah. Well, let's face it. Hezbollah had killed more Americans, 246 of them, as a matter of fact. Before 9/11, they had killed more Americans than anybody else. And I looked at her and I said, look, I've delivered 2 kids in my life. None of them were mine. I ain't about to do the third. So I forced her to go home. I had one of our logistics guys take her home that night. I saw her again a few years later, and she came to me and she said, you know, every birthday that my daughter has, I think of you, because you forced me to get out of there. And the moral of the story is, the strongest drive in the human race is the mother instinct to protect her child. And this woman, 8 months pregnant, was able to turn that off and stay in harm's way to get her job done.
And there's a really beautiful vignette at the end of the book where you discuss Dewey Claridge phones you up and said, you need to come. And you go and the two of you sit and you have this moment where you realize that he's passing the torch on to you. I was wondering, have you thought to yourself, who's the person that I'm going to pass the torch on to? Dewey?
I already have, actually.
You already have? Can you tell us who?
Yeah. I cannot mention it by name. My old deputy, for one, in that last effort that ended up being extremely high rank in the agency, he was a guy that was always smarter than I was and just as good as anything as I was. I would consider him like one of the two or three people that I actually mentored and passed on the baton inside the agency and even afterwards. My deal with Dewey was actually helping him post my agency career. I was still working with the community. This is outside of the book, so I cannot go into details. But for the next 8 years after retirement, I did nothing different than run programs for the community in a very different way. And Dewey, that was one of the things he wanted me to take over, was some of these great thing connectivities that he had here and there. And it ended up being really sexy things to run. But it was never a career thing. It was always a purpose. And, you know, I made some mistakes as a lot of young guys would do by being kind of a jerk, getting into fights and crap. But, you know, I believe that we can build enough good karma that it will get us to the right afterlife, as far as I'm concerned. And for me, it was always that mission. For me, it was the purifying fire. For me, was the agency and pararescue. I'm very proud, very, very proud. I would have not gotten into the agency if I had not been for pararescue.
It's been so great to speak to you. I could speak to you all night. Just to bring it to a close, I think there's another really beautiful vignette at the beginning of the book, which I alluded to earlier. You're 7 years old. You're looking out of the window and you see this gorilla on your front porch firing into a bar that policemen used to frequent, and then your journey to be where you are now. And I guess the question is, have you been back to Cuba? Is there still that part of you inside that still longs to go home, or do you feel like you've moved on now? And help me understand.
You know, Cuba is my roots. That's my cultural roots. That's my family roots. I'm very proud of being Cuban born. I'm an American, first and foremost. That I have an affinity towards Cuba, of course, because that's home. You're giving me more credit probably that is deserved in that sense. I mean, I didn't plan any of this. These things just were things that came in my way, and I had to walk some, and the other ones I chose to walk. But it is not that unique. I will tell you, I have a very good friend of mine. I will not mention his name because I can't. But agency guy, that's how he retired from the agency, senior grade. But he was in the Bay of Pigs as a 17-year-old. He turned 18 in a Cuban jail. When Kennedy extricated them through the trade of tractors and medicines, he joined the Green Berets and he went to Vietnam. And he had tours in Vietnam. Then he came back. And he went to Georgetown, got his degree, and then joined the agency and had a fantastic career and retired at SIS something. So organizations like the agency have a lot of Rick Prados. We will never have a shortage of warriors. We could do better in leadership, but we'll never have a shortage of people that are willing to go in harm's way. And that was the fascinating thing for me in working with the CIA was that if I looked right or left, I saw people that I admired. Some junior to me, some senior to me, some of my peers, but were people that I was extremely, extremely proud to be part of. And again, that's why I'm writing the book, because I want the average American to see what a real CIA operation looks like. Not Jason Bourne, not James Bond, as many books of his as I read. That's not what we do. I'm still waiting for my Austin Martin. We don't. He was a Scot, right? And so,
come to the Spy Museum. We have one in the lobby.
I know. I might drive it off. but it was that trajectory that being seen the amount of talent and conviction and patriotism that all my peers display day in and day out was humbling. Very rewarding career.
I think that's one of the things that in a humble way I'm trying to do with the podcast is to humanize intelligence professionals. You know, they're regular folks in some senses, but extraordinary folks in other senses. that's one of the humble goals I have for the podcast, just to try to get these stories out there.
And I truly appreciate your time on this and your effort on this, because it's very important to me. You know, when my grandson was born and I was starting to read, I said, I don't want him to learn about the agency from the movies. So it's great. Well, the next time that we talk, I will tell you my Scottish story when I went to MI6. That's exactly what happened. The Scott guy that was my counterpart taught me how to drink single malt scotch and was just getting into cigars, and I taught him about cigars. So why not do it again with another good Scott?
Let's do it. Thanks so much for your time, Rick. It's been really a pleasure to speak to you. I've enjoyed it very much, and I really loved your book, and I hope it does gangbusters and everybody hears about your incredible story.
Look forward to meeting you in person. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spycast. Go to our webpage where you can find links to further resources, detailed show notes, and full transcripts. We have over 500 episodes in our back catalogue for you to explore. Please follow the show on Twitter at @intlspycast and share your favourite quotes and insights, or start a conversation. If you have any additional feedback, please email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Hammond, and you can connect with me on LinkedIn or follow me on Twitter @spyhistorian. This show is brought to you from the home of the world's preeminent collection of intelligence and espionage-related artifacts, the International Spy Museum. The Spycast team includes Mike Mincy and Memphis Vaughn III. See you for next week's show.
Shall we start?
Shall we start?
What I experience.
What I experience.
It's awesome.
It's awesome.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Right.
I ask myself why it took so long. So at my late age.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. It's awesome. It's amazing. It's awesome.
I ask myself why it took so long. Can't question God when he wanna do things. So at my late age, it's just started coming.
It's amazing, amazing, amazing.
It's amazing. It's awesome. It's amazing. It's awesome.
De muren en gedachten, discussies in je hoofd. vaker vergeet. Luister dan naar dit sterke verhaal. Meer is er niet in de wereld dan een sprookje. Geloof me. Zwaluwen sluipen zwevend in de lucht. Maar ze keren toch altijd weer. Vogelvlucht zonder vlucht. Wanneer je opgesloten zit, tot de zwaarte en het licht. Er is er niet in de wereld dan een sprookje, geloof me. Zwaluwen slapen zwevend in de lucht. Maar ze keren toch altijd weer. Het is een vogelvlucht zonder vlucht. Zwaluwen slapen zwevend in de lucht.
Dank je allemaal. I'll do this in English, because I know there's some English-speaking folks around. Hey, Will. Hi. So I said, yeah, this is a fairy tale, but it's actually not. Swallows or starlings, they actually, a little fun fact, they actually sleep in the sky. They go like circles. They sleep in the sky. I don't know. I was amazed by that story. My father's a farmer, so he tells me these little, like, you know, nuggets of nature wisdom, and it's really cool. So yeah, here's a little fun fact for you. Next song up is Kom Niet Dichterbij. Sorry, it's all only Dutch songs, guys. Je hoort zo vrij en o zo onbevangen. Maar wat zou er omgaan in die gedachtegangen? Je lijkt zo sterk en oh zo ongenaakbaar. Maar in werkelijkheid ben jij net zo breekbaar. Kom aan me even vast en vrijblijvend vrije. Maar kom alsjeblieft niet dichterbij. Nee, kom niet dichterbij mij. Kom niet dichterbij mij. Kom niet dichterbij mij. Ik laat jou vrij, wij allebei. Je zegt dat je bent weggegooid van jouw gevoelens. Waar zou je daarmee nou in hemelsnaam weer op doelen? Het zal verloren zijn gegaan in vertaling. Koude handen, sorry. Of jou en mij misschien, wederom weer in de maling. Maar zolang de maan is en zo lang de zon. En zolang de morgen weer van vooraf aan begon. red ik mezelf wel en nog veel meer dan dat. En ik ben absoluut niet jouw eeuwig warme bad. Ik ben nu bereid van niemand, ik red mezelf. Ik red mezelf wel als ik strand. Maar kom niet dichter bij mij. Kom niet dichter bij mij. Kom niet dichter bij mij. Ik laat jou vrij, wij allebei. Toen zei je mij, ik zie je wel, dus wees maar gerust. En toen was ik mij een moment even niet bewust. En toen was jij zomaar ineens, toch zomaar ineens, was jij dichterbij. Jij dichterbij mij. One last song. Oh, very cool, guys. I'm glad that you guys are in the sun. That's nice. I'll join you in a bit. Ending for the song. Thanks a lot, guys. Can we give it up for Emma and Lucien and the whole crew who are reclaiming the seats already? It's not done yet, of course. Well, thanks a lot. And in a bit, Stan is playing some tunes, so stick around. Enjoy. Thank you.
Come with me.